There's a switch over here I'm supposed to hit when I get to start talking. And since I never stop talking, it's hard to know when to switch, hit the switch. So Sunday, Shannon's little boy, young son, Braxton, he's not a little boy, he's a young man, had a question. And so based on Brody's Devo, which I absolutely do we have a great Devo tonight or what? Just all the way around was wonderful. So Brody convicted my heart to appreciate God's creation work, because I do the same thing Brody does. I'll sit there and drive and be oblivious to what's going on. And so Braxton asked the question, and basically, if God made us and gave us this planet, and we have, and it's, as Brody said, it's just far enough away from the sun to be livable and not too far away to be uninhabitable, then why do we have all these other stars and planets and galaxies and all this other stuff? Why do we, I mean, we haven't even found the ends of it yet and can't even begin to guess how many planets and how many solar systems and how many galaxies. And so I'll open the floor to you guys. If there's one planet that has life on it, then God made us in his image, and he did, and he gave us this planet as our home, then why all this too many to count other planets and galaxies and star systems? Any wisdom? Maybe it just looks like there's lots.
Maybe you get out there and there's not really that much out there. You know what I mean?
All right, so maybe it's an illusion. Okay, all right.
To give us something beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
It helps us navigate.
Helps us navigate. But long before there was GPS, there was the sextant and stars to navigate from. And we can navigate the seas with that long before there was anything that would give us directions. To teach us something about God. And what might it teach us about God?
How vast
God is. Bigger than we can imagine, like the stars in the sky or the sand on the shore, which is the promise he made to Abraham, right? His descendants. And I maybe not just the vastness of God, this omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent being, but the vastness of his love for us. To give us those things, not only to enjoy the beauty, but something to explore and something to imagine and something to dream and something to reach for.
No.
Okay. All right. Chelsea says no. I guess it's time to move on. Anyway, I just thought that was amazing. I thought that was just a wonderful question from a wonderful young man, a wonderful Devo, and from four great young men. We have some great young men, great young ladies in our congregation. And if they are the future of the church, I think they're more the present than the future. But if they are the future of the church, then the church is in good hands. We're in great shape. All right, we're in Acts chapter 24. Lots of amazing stuff going on in Acts chapter 24. This is one of those where you get to peek behind the curtain and just see a little bit of the world in the first century, a little bit of how their world worked, a little bit of how they moved and conducted themselves in the world, and how the world kind of conducted them sometimes. Paul, at this point in Acts chapter 24, his world's been turned upside down. The guy who had always had freedom and always exercised that freedom and always exercised that freedom to serve God, even when he was serving the wrong way, he would travel and to persecute the church. Then he traveled to spread the gospel. His identity has always been in his faith. He's always been someone, first of all, a Pharisee from the tribe of Benjamin, a Pharisee among Pharisees, lived in all good conscience to this day, he says. Hebrew of Hebrews, an apostle of Christ. And so now he finds in Acts 24, his freedom is now being taken away from him. He's being held prisoner. He's going to be held prisoner in a palace, a palace before, but he's going to be held prisoner, and he's also finding it necessary now to emphasize not just his relationship with God and his citizenship in the kingdom. He's finding it necessary now to emphasize his Roman citizenship, because that's what changed the atmosphere in the barracks in Jerusalem. It prevented him from taking a scourging, and also that's what's earned him an audience with Governor Felix in Caesarea. And so we pick up tonight in Acts chapter 24 with Paul before Felix in Caesarea. And so read with me a few verses. We're going to be in Acts chapter 24. We'll start in verse 9. It will be on the screen, but I'd love for you to read along with me in your own Bible if you'd like. Acts chapter 24, beginning in verse 1. 5 days later, this is after the scuffle in Jerusalem. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. "We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him. By examining him yourself, you'll be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. The Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true." We'll stop there for just a minute. So the trial before Felix begins with the customary formalities, and one of those formalities is opening remarks. We said 5 days. 5 days is just enough time for the Jews in Jerusalem to finish Pentecost, to select a delegation and a spokesman for their delegation, and then travel to Caesarea for the trial. So things are moving rather quickly. And as soon as all the interested parties are present in verses 2 and following, before Felix, the trial begins, and Tertullus, the lawyer, makes his opening remarks. He's literally orator, and many of your translations say orator, and that's a literal reading. The lawyer is more of an interpretation than a translation. By the way, just an aside, Tertullus means third. So I wonder if they named their first two kids first and second. But he's third. Tertullus is third. And he begins his opening statements in what's very much expected, which is flattering the head of the trial, Felix. And so he gives some flattering words to him. Notice as we go through this, the distinct difference between the Jewish Sanhedrin and the Roman court before Governor Felix. Notice how much differently the Jews do things than the Romans. Now, we'd like to think, since the Jews are the ones who wrote this history, or wrote most of our history, and certainly are all of our history in the Old Testament, that they would be the heroes of the story. But there's a radical difference between the way the Israelites handled their trial, the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, versus how Tertullus and Felix are going to handle, and Paul are going to handle, the trial here in Caesarea. Don't lose your place in 24, but let's go back to 22:30, and just for a little reminder of what happened in Jerusalem. 22 verse 30. Jesus had been grabbed by the commander at the Roman garrison. And it says, "The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them." Now, there's something I glossed over last time. I tend to do it on a regular basis. How do you think the Sanhedrin and the chief priests felt when a pagan military commander orders them to come before him, or orders them to hold court? Middle way through verse 30, he released Paul and ordered, my translation says, ordered the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Don't you just know that they loved having a secular military leader order them to assemble a religious tribunal or court? Anyway, chapter 23, verse 1, Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him in the mouth. Then Paul said to him, 'God will strike you, you whitewashed wall.'" So here we start off with some really wonderful formal proceedings. I don't like what the witness said. Let's smack him in the face. Go down to verse 6. Then Paul, knowing some of them were Sadducees and other Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." And when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. And then they all of a sudden decide, the Pharisees anyway, that there's nothing, that Paul's done nothing wrong. You know, we think this guy's on track. So the Jewish Supreme Court, this is the highest authority in the land in Israel, is chaotic. That's the nicest word I can think to say. It's just chaotic. It's poorly managed. It's poorly conducted. There's just nothing professional about it. And these are supposed to be God's representatives. Now remember, these are the Israelites. These are the people who are supposed to be pointing the world to God. And they're anything but godly. And now as we come back to chapter 24 and follow through the trial, you're going to see this is going to be a very orderly assembly that we have. Back in 24 verse 2, the orators or lawyers, Tertullus's comments to Felix are meant to impress. It's the proper smoozing, if you would, with the court. And the problem is, Felix's reign really wasn't a very good reign. Governor Felix was not a very good governor. He certainly wasn't anything Tertullus said he was. His reign was characterized by unrest and worsening relationship between the Jews and the Romans. It was not, as Tertullus says in verse 2, a long period of peace. That is nice hyperbole, but it's really not true. And in fact, history tells us that a couple of years after this trial, Rome will basically fire Felix. They'll recall him for the very reason of this worsening relationship between the Jews and the Romans, and even more. But the image of Felix as the peacemaker that Tertullus paints, wonderful Felix, Governor Felix, you are the wonderful peacemaker. You are a great contrast to this horrible Paul, who's a terror to the world. And so that's really the contrast he's trying. You're a wonderful, great person and wise and insightful, and you're a wonderful peacemaker, and you're the opposite of what this horrible person is who's on trial. That's really what the lawyer's trying to set up. And so beginning in verse 5, the lawyer's charges against Paul fall into a couple of basic categories. And first in verse 5, he makes just some general charges. Paul's accused of being a troublemaker. The New American Standard Updated says he's a real pest. The King James says he's a pestilent fellow. And RSV does as well. And the New King James says he's a plague. Not very complimentary. He's also accused, so he's a troublemaker, a real pest, a pestilent fellow, a plague. Also, he's stirring up riots all over the world. That's an interesting phrase, all over the world. Paul was given an assignment that took him all over the world. What was that assignment? Go preach the word. You go preach the word. And so he was given a task to preach the word all over the world. And the lawyer finds in that the source and the cause for all these horrible actions of Paul. Now, did Paul's preaching ever lead to unrest? Yeah.
Did it never not lead to unrest?
Yeah. And is unrest too mild a word? I mean, can we say riot? I mean, did Paul's preaching have a tendency to rile people up? Yes. Acts chapter 13, Pisidian Antioch. There was some problems there. In chapter 14 in Iconium. Later in chapter 14 in Lystra. In chapter 17 in Thessalonica, in chapter 18 in Corinth, in chapter 21 and 22 and 23 in Jerusalem. And so let's give the lawyer credit. Paul tends to leave trouble in his wake. That's not his assignment, though. He's faithfully fulfilling his assignment to proclaim the gospel. It's the reception of the gospel, the way people hear and respond to the gospel that's causing the uproar. But here's this troublemaker, this plague, two general charges. He's a troublemaker, he's a plague, and he's stirring up riots all over the world. Not only that, Paul is accused of being a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. I think that's in verse 5, isn't it? Yeah, do you have something in your, this is the old NIV, do you have anything significantly different than that? A ringleader of the Nazarene sect in the end of verse 5? I usually try to note something if there's something that's markedly different. A ringleader of the Nazarene sect. What's it? There's a reason why he says that. What is he trying to convey? Well, first of all, ringleader has its own kind of connotation, right? I mean, you don't normally use ringleader in a positive connotation. So he's the head of this group. Well, when he throws Nazarene sect out of there, there's some really powerful subtext there. What would that be?
Potential uprising.
I'm sorry?
Potential uprising?
Absolutely. Ringleader, that just begs there's going to be a problem, right? What do we know about Nazarene? Nazareth? Or better yet, what kind of reputation does Nazareth have?
Can anything good
come out of Nazareth? Nazareth is a little hole in the wall. Nazareth is a little podunk nothing in the middle of nowhere.
No.
So tell me, I did this once and I got in real trouble with somebody. I'm not going to say who it was, but she really defends Kiefer really strongly. So well, her initials are Debbie Witt Church, but I won't say any more than that. So I don't want to use Kiefer anymore. I've learned my lesson. But give me a name of a little town that wanted to kind of compete with Tulsa. That would be if somebody told you this town wants to compete with Tulsa on any level, you'd go, that's nothing. It can't be Kiefer. Okay, it's Kiefer. All right. So imagine somebody's going, well, Kiefer, this ringleader from Kiefer, what he's basically saying is Paul thinks he's a little fish in a little pond. He thinks he's more than that. But you and I know, Governor Felix, lawyer Tertullus, we know that he's a little fish from a little pond. Therefore, he can't be worth this much trouble. He's causing a lot more trouble than he's worth. And so just all the different layers of what's going on is just amazing. Okay, so he's the ringleader of the Nazarene sect. As Nathanael said to Philip in John chapter 1, Nazareth, can anything good come from there? He's a little fish in a little pond. And then in verse 6, he moves from these just general charges into more specific charge. Paul's accused of trying to desecrate the temple. By the way, we're going back to the original accusation against Paul back when he was, you remember, when all this started at the temple and the big mob came up and wanted to beat him up. And by the way, it's fascinating to watch the Jews paint the Romans as the bad guys. We were trying to do something and the Romans came and took him by force. Romans trying to paint the Jews as bad. The Jews were trying to kill him. We had to go rescue him from the Jews. So, I mean, you get this he said thing going on. But we're back to the original charge that showed up back in chapter 21. He's trying to desecrate the temple. He's brought Greeks into the temple and defiled his holy place. Keep your place in 24. Let's go back to 21 real quick. 21 verse, we'll start in verse 27. Chapter 21, verse 27. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from where? The province of Asia. The province of Asia. Saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law in this place. And besides, he's brought Greeks into the temple and area and defiled this holy place." interesting connection here. Randy? Well, I won't do that. Although you are the Revelation expert, I won't do that. The seven letters in Revelation, they're written to the churches in the province of what? Asia. Where are these troublemakers from? The province of Asia. Jesus decides to dictate letters to John for John to dictate to send to the churches. You think it's just random? He goes, there's been a lot of trouble out of these churches in Asia. And so all of these churches that are written in Revelation, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, they're all from Asia. And so here's these troublemakers that are from this same region. And now that charge that was made in chapter 21 has followed him now to Caesarea. It was made in Jerusalem in chapter 21. It has followed him to Caesarea now in chapter 24. That he's desecrated the temple and defiled the holy place. Now, some of the translations, some of your translations, if you're reading from King James, New King James, American Standard, New American Standard, New American Standard Updated, you'll have a verse 7 in 24. If you're reading from the NIV, the ESV, or the RSV, you don't. If you have New American Standard Updated, you'll find the latter part of verse 6 and verse 7 in brackets. And probably in any of your Bibles, you might find a footnote. You have a footnote between verse 6 and 8 in your Bibles. What does your footnote say? Okay, yeah. So we have a little more explanation here in verse 7. This really all boils down to how you weigh the priority of a manuscript. Do you weigh the older manuscripts do you consider the older manuscripts to be more weighty and therefore most of them don't have verse 7, the latter part of verse 6 and 7, or do you consider the more recent manuscripts to be more weighty, more important, and they do have the latter part of verse 6 and verse 7? So the translators of NIV, ESV, RSV decided they were going to go old school and leave the latter part of 6 and 7 out. The other ones decided they were going to go new school and put them in. But almost all of our Bibles have some sort of a footnote. I say all of ours. The New American Standard and the ones who went old school will often have a footnote in there. And I think even one of them, one of the old school has an asterisk. Maybe New American Standard. New American Standard has, the latest New American Standard has brackets. Anyway, some information there based on manuscript valuing. We want to do a judgment according to our own law, but Lysias the commander came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordered his accusers to come before you. So we had this handled until one of your guys got in the middle of it, and now here we are in front of you. It's not our fault. Don't blame us for taking your time. Blame one of your own commanders. And in verse 8, Tertullus invites Governor Felix to examine the charges himself, and he flatters Felix by feigning confidence in Felix's ability to learn, this is out of verse 8, to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. We know you can do it. You can. And we're sorry that one of your guys made this your problem, but we have all confidence in you. You can get to the bottom of this because you're smarter than the rest of us. And so clearly if you are, then you'll find our charges correct and accurate and worthy of your attention. Pretty good lawyering there. The Jews joining the accusation, verse 9. By the way, the Jews, if we look back in verse 1, are the high priest Ananias and some elders. And on one hand, you could say, well, okay, they're mere presence. They've made the trip from Jerusalem to Caesarea, and Ananias and the elders. So clearly their presence in the court would suggest their agreement with the with Tertullus' side, the Jews' side, but they also evidently feel the need to voice their affirmation as well, and so they do join in the accusations. So that's Tertullus' opening comments for the trial, and next, starting in about verse 10, we get Paul's address, Paul's opening comments in the trials. Thoughts, anything before we move on?
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to Acts 24. Let's start picking up. Let's pick up in verse 10 where we left off. Acts 24, 10. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you've been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make now my defense." Notice the difference between his flattering remarks and Tertullus' flattering remarks. Verse 11. "You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogue or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges they are making now against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man." And he's speaking the truth there. So we'll stop. So Paul joins with the lawyer in making his opening comments and the obligatory flattery. You've got to grease the wheel a little bit. But he refers to Felix as a judge. That's accurate. That's not necessarily flattery. That's accurate. As opposed to Tertullus referring to him as most excellent Felix. Little back rub there. And if you remember Lysias' letter that he sent in chapter 23, His Excellency Governor Felix. So everybody's cowing down to Governor Felix. Paul shows him respect, but he also manages to keep his dignity in doing that, his integrity. He shows respect, but he doesn't grovel or crawl in front of him. And Paul states in verse 11 that his purpose of the temple was to worship, not to riot, not to cause trouble, not to desecrate. You remember the agreement? You remember what it was suggested to Paul? You know, there's been people that say that you teach against Moses and against following his law. There's four guys here that have finished their vows, and they're going to come offer sacrifices. Why don't you buy the sacrifices for them? Come join them in their sacrifices. And we talked when that happened about how Paul might have been conflicted with that. He does teach that the law has been fulfilled and the law is no longer binding on God's people, not under the Christian covenant. And so we talked about how that might give a kind of a conflicting message if he's saying Christians are no longer bound by the law of Moses, but I'm going to come to Jerusalem and follow the law of Moses. By the way, could Paul preach in the synagogues when he's traveling around if he were not ceremonially clean and up to date? No, he kept the law, not because he believed that was his road to eternity or his opening to God. He kept it because it left him open to be able to proclaim the gospel wherever he went. And so he goes to Jerusalem, and his plan was to come, I'm going to go to the temple, I'm going to worship with these guys, and we're going to offer sacrifices. He was trying to do everything in his power to keep the peace, everything in his power to calm the uneasiness of people who were saying that he's teaching against Moses and against the law. And the script just flips on him. He's doing everything in his power to try to keep everything smooth and calm. And these Jews from Asia come and make these accusations and stir everything up. And it's amazing to me, it may not be to you, but it is to me, how quickly supposedly reasonable, mature, intelligent people get worked up in a frenzy by false accusations. But here they are. So verse 11, Paul says he was there to worship. And since the offenses occurred very recently, he says no more than 12 days ago, it shouldn't be hard to find witnesses. Basically, this is recent history. If you want to find eyewitnesses, they're there. I don't know about you, but I find it interesting. Do you think Paul had some friends in Jerusalem? Do you think he had some allies in Jerusalem? Some like-minded believers in Jerusalem? He probably did. You remember he was taking the collection from the saints in the West? And by all indications, the church in Jerusalem accepted that contribution. Wouldn't you think that would generate some goodwill between Paul and the believers there in Jerusalem? And where are they in all this? Where were they at the temple when he was being accused of desecrating the temple? Where are they in Caesarea? They may be all around, and Luke just, that wasn't a necessary piece of information to move this account along. But from everything we have to work with, they were AWOL. I find that fascinating. At the time that they should have been by his side and standing with him, there's no mention of him anywhere. And so he says, this is recent history. If you want to find witnesses to verify Paul's claim, there should be plenty around to do so. Verse 12, his accusers didn't find him, arguing with him at the temple, stirring up a crowd in the synagogue, anywhere else in the city. And verse 13, Paul's accusers can't prove to Felix any of the charges they're making. All that's true, by the way. Whether or not it helps him at all, it's all true. He does make an admission in verse 14. And his admission is that he worships God a little differently than a lot of the Jews do. And really, that's kind of at the core of what the whole problem is. He's different. He worships a little differently. Judaism was a Roman-approved religion. And he talks about verse 12, worship, or at least verse 14, I think it is, worshiping the God of our fathers. And if you've read, one of the motives behind the book of Acts is, you remember, Luke was evidently hired by a most excellent Theophilus. Theophilus was evidently the one who financed the research and the writing that Luke did. One of the thoughts is the reason behind that was as a defense for Paul. So Paul's been arrested in Caesarea. He's heading for Rome. Luke writes this account, what we would call biographical account, biography, and it's meant to be used as a defense when he goes before the emperor in Rome. And this certainly leans into that. When Paul says that he worships the same God as the Israelites, because Judaism was an approved religion among the Roman Empire. Christianity was not at that time. And depending on who you ask during that time, would they see Christianity as a standalone religion completely separate from Judaism, or would they see it just as another subset of the Israelite worship, Israelite religion? But Paul's basic premise is, I worship the same God the Israelites do. I do it a little differently, but I worship the same God they do. And so if this was a defense for Paul, Paul's defense is, Judaism is accepted by the Roman Empire, and I worship the same God as the Jews. I just do it a little differently. So Paul believes that worshiping the same God worshiping that same God as a follower of the way agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. Agrees with the law and all that's written in the prophets. I think it's a reference to 2 Timothy 3:15. So Paul says, I'm doing things that agree with our scriptures, with what we would call the Old Testament. In verse 15, he defends Christianity's legality again by affirming the same hope in God. I don't know if he was trying to stir up another hornet's nest between the Pharisees and the Sadducees about resurrection, but he's throwing basically the same line out there. Not every Jew held the hope of a resurrection. The Sadducees didn't, but Paul's fellow Pharisees did. And because of his hope of the resurrection, verse 16, Paul strives, he does his best to keep a clear conscience before God and man. Paul believed that Christianity was the fulfillment of the Judaism, that Judaism was all pointing toward Christ, and now that Christ is here, that fulfills Judaism. And so that would also maintain Christianity's legality under the Roman law. So he believes that he and his fellow Christians are not breaking any laws. He isn't anything. His Christianity hasn't done anything. They can't prove anything. It's all false. And everything he says is true. Now, Tertullus is making stuff up out of whole cloth. Sounds good, and it plays to Felix, but he's making stuff up out of whole cloth. So we have truth versus untruth. We have a very, what I see here, and maybe you see something different, but what I see here is a very systematic, very organized, very proper legal trial, or trial, legal or not, versus the Sanhedrin, which was just a madhouse. And so to me, the people who were supposed to be God's, the people who were God's elect and supposed to be God's representative to the world are really shining bad. They're showing poorly. They're not whole, they don't have an orderly means of discerning truth. They seem to run on emotion and anger. They seem to default to violence very quickly. And while the pagan Romans, who should be the ones who are the underdogs, should be the bad guys, the ones that are, you know, you don't want to be like them, are really setting the standard for finding truth, for holding to an orderly system for trying to seek the truth. Tertullus is making up lies out of whole cloth. Paul's telling the truth. And so here's what you see is Christianity is Judaism, which was the standard in the Old Covenant. Christianity started down and low, and now you see Christianity becoming the standard in Judaism, basically coming, let me say, just unraveling. I'll just put it that way. Okay, Paul has more to say in chapter 24, verse 17, but that was number one, Bill. Thoughts, comments? Critiques, criticisms, anything?
You know, they call him a pest.
Pestilence.
So that means that he's really not much of a person to them. And then they spend all this time and all this money trying to put him before a jury.
Yes.
Everything he's doing is wrong.
Yeah.
And they're building a case against themselves that is going to come back and get them.
You're building a house of cards that's going to fall down around their ears. So while you mention that, one little quickie here. That word plague or pestilence or whatever pestilent fellow, there's only one other place in the entire Bible where that word shows up, and it's in Luke chapter 21, verse 11. Just look at the context there. If you want to get a sense of how unflattering these comments were, Luke 21 and verse 11. By the way, these are signs of the end of the age. Teacher, they asked verse 7, when will these things happen and what will be the sign that we're about to take place? Verse 8, Luke 21 verse 8, he replied, watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name claiming I am he, and the time is near. Do not follow them. When you hear wars and revolutions, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but then the end will come away. Then he said to them, nation will rage against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Verse 11, and here we go. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilence. That's the only other time in all the Bible that shows up. So we got Paul, and we got the end of the world. The lawyer saying, this guy is the end of the world. So yeah, they're trying to make a pretty bad case. And he's not the problem. They are the problem. We'll leave with this with closing thought. This is when the world's turned upside down. The good are bad. The bad are good. The good guy is being held in prison. The bad guys are out running around making accusations, false accusations. They're calling Paul the end of the world. He's the plague, the pestilence. They're really the problem. And it looks like everything is just falling apart. Paul's no longer free. He's no longer, he can, and now he has to emphasize his Roman citizenship versus his citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. But we know the rest of the story. And so even when it looks like everything's falling apart, who's still in charge? God's still in charge. I'll leave you with that. So that if you're in a situation, or when you're in a situation where it just looks like everything's falling apart, God's in charge. He's working. He's working his will, not only through his followers, but through everybody else. God's in charge, even when it looks like he's not. God bless you. Thank you for your help. We are dismissed.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Remind us, we're not all that.
And when Victor Glover was being interviewed, somebody asked him, "What did you say when you looked out?" He said, "Oh my God, and it wasn't in vain."
Yeah. Good point. Thank you so much. God bless you.